Welcome to Thinking Ahead. I'm your host, Carter Phipps, and we're exploring the movements, trends, people, and ideas that are shaping our evolving world. Make sure you subscribe today on your favorite podcast platform, and most of all, I hope you enjoy today's episode. Jeffrey Kripal has carved out a unique place in American culture. He's an academic, a professor of religious studies at Rice University. But Lord knows what I would have given in my collegiate days to have a professor with his range of experience and knowledge in mysticism, philosophy, esoteric thought, Gnosticism, spirituality, human potential, and so much more. Kripal's work extends beyond the academic world as well. For example, he spent a number of years as chairman of the board at Esalen in California. And yes, that's Esalen Retreat Center, home of the human potential movement. He's also a prolific author who's written numerous books and over 90 essays and been deeply involved in a couple of films as well. All in all, developing a body of work that is impressive and groundbreaking. He's even endured controversy and censorship for some of his work, for questioning some sacred cows of Eastern mysticism. In particular, that was true with his book, Kali's Child, The Mystical and Erotic in the Life and Teachings of Ramakrishna. And you can probably tell from the title what was controversial about it. I'll highlight just a couple of other books as well. One is on, we mentioned Esalen earlier, but it's called Esalen, America and the Religion of No Religion, which is a highly recommended history of that institution. And I particularly love Mystics and Mutants, Science Fiction, Superhero Comics, and the Paranormal. It's brilliant and delightful, and it hints at this deeper relationship between the evolution of consciousness and the evolution of culture, even pop culture in this case, that has been part of his work and has certainly inspired some of my own work as well. And finally, that brings me to another of Kripal's contributions, his efforts to bring the paranormal into the realm of authentic academic study. And it's not something we've traditionally seen in religious departments. And yet it's very much part of our spiritual and religious culture in the West and beyond. Why shouldn't it be more carefully studied? So from the evolution of consciousness to the exploration of mysticism to the pursuit of the paranormal, Kripal's work has made room, really, for a new generation of scholars to branch out and honestly study more dimensions of what lights up America's spiritual and religious life. I think he's one of the most important figures in progressive spirituality today. Let's welcome Jeff Kripal to Thinking Ahead. All right. Well, welcome, Jeff, to Thinking Ahead. It's great to have you on the podcast.
Yeah. No, always, Carter. It's my pleasure, really.
So I mean, there's so many things we could talk about, but I'd love to pick your brain a bit and hear about what you're working on. And you're a very prolific author. You recently, over 6 months or so, sent me some stuff you were writing, which was fantastic. Congratulations. I'm sure that's moved forward. But when I think of your work, Jeff, I just think you've held this and are holding this kind of place in culture. You have this sort of, you're involved in the academic world and the study of spirituality and mysticism and religion. In that context, you've been in Esalen and the human potential movement. You've written widely. How many books now? You've got 6, 7 books?
There's 8 single authored books and then a pile of co-authored and edited volumes.
That is so impressive. That is so impressive. And it seems like I see your name around a lot on other people's books. You're holding a kind of, the spiritual but not religious movement has been going in earnest for a century, but it's been really going in earnest since the 60s and 70s. And it's waxed and waned at times. But for holding that place for authentic mysticism and culture, and from an intellectual point of view too, you have done so much to kind of be a figure in that movement. So congratulations for doing that. When I look out and I see you in all these places kind of holding that space, I think how important that is for so many people who sort of look to you as a validation of that space, and you've really held that well. So Yeah. So I'd love to know what are you working on now? What's lighting you up? What's exciting?
So, yeah. Before we get into that, and I'm happy to talk about that. I mean, this notion of holding a space, people want that space carved out of the forest, as it were. And the work, I really think of the work as a kind of carving out this space in the forest so more people can come and sit around the campfire and tell stories and kind of build community. And, you know, sometimes that work has to be done on a kind of professional or institutional level, even though I think most of it's actually done entirely outside those professional or institutional dimensions. I mean, I sit in the center in some ways of, you know, this elite academic culture, but I spend my life writing about popular culture and comic books and science fiction and, you know, weird spiritual communities and even weirder people. I count myself among those weirder people, and I feel a great deal of affection. I would even say love for those people. And my work in the academy is just really a function of, well, this is where I find myself and this is where I can do the most damage and let's do it, you know? So that's very conscious, Carter. I guess what I'm trying to say, it's very conscious and very intentional. And
yeah,
it's not perfect and it's not the only thing that needs to be done, but it does need to be done by someone. And I'm like, well, let's do it then. You know, that's kind of my attitude.
Well, as someone who's sort of, you know, myself, who also sort of held a space for a lot of people around that campfire for a number of years as an editor of a magazine that was on these subjects and sort of, you know, found myself curious about all of the people who are holding a lot of that space and are telling stories today in that sort of mystical spiritual movement. And also fascinated by the history of it and how we've got here and the history of some of that. You talk in your recent book about cosmic humanism and the religion of no religion and those kinds of movements. There were very few people who held that explicitly in an academic context. There were a lot of people in the academic world who were sympathetic and were very interested and curious, but there were very few people who were studying it explicitly. And I felt like you really came along and you just said, hey, let's make this a study of, and you brought it out into the open in a way that was different and unique. Cause it really arose, as you say, outside of institutional walls.
Yeah. Well, there's two things to say there. And, you know, one is, so I came to these particular people and these particular topics in about, I don't know, 2005 or so. I was finishing up the book on Esalen, and I was meeting and interacting with all of these weird people, as I call them. And I realized that the stories they were telling me were basically all true, and that I had no way of even acknowledging these stories. I'd, you know, been in the study of religion and mystical literature for 25 years at that point, and I realized that I just had nothing. You know, I was standing there with my hands open and clueless about what these people were telling me. And so I set out to try to understand how that could happen, how the study of religion could be so impoverished around these kinds of experiences. And so I wrote this book called Authors of the Impossible. And what I realized writing that book was, and this is really big for me, was that all these categories of the psychical or the paranormal were actually all coined by academics. Mm. And they were at the center of the intellectual lives of all these elite intellectuals in the 19th and early 20th century.
Right.
And it's really only because of the last 100 years of the 20th century that those topics get dismissed and marginalized. But at their root, they're all intellectual and they're deeply philosophical. Mm. And really, really smart people were fascinated by them. And I thought then, and I think now, it's a complete shame that intellectuals aren't fascinated by them now. And so that's what I set out to do, is just try to make that fashionable again or doable again. Mm-hmm. And the other thing that happened to me, Carter, which was really, I think, really moving, actually, is I started to go around the country in Europe lecturing about these things, mm-hmm. and just kind of became a jester, as it were, of the paranormal, you know, just trying to provoke people to think about these things and talk about them. And what I found over and over and over again is that my colleagues and the students and even the administrators I ran into, they were all in the closet.
Yeah.
They were actually deeply sympathetic. They just didn't want to step out of the closet and talk about these things because they didn't want to sound like the tabloids.
Yeah.
And so what I learned to do at some point was just go into a university or an intellectual space and perform what it might look like to make these things into true serious topics. And people were like, wow, that makes total sense. And, you know, I want to do that. And so people always ask me, well, how do you deal with the pushback? And I'm like, what pushback? I mean, people love this stuff and they want to think about it. And it's not that there aren't doubts, right?
Yeah, sure.
I have tons of doubts, but it's that there are ways to think about this rigorously and thoughtfully.
Yeah.
And so that's what I've tried to do. And other people, lots of other people did it before me and lots of people did it after. I mean, I'm just one person trying to get other people to do it.
Yeah. Right. And inspiring, you are inspiring other people to do it, but somehow there'd been a Darth for a while. Yeah. I think of people.
Oh yeah. Okay.
You, and just so the readers understand, it's like, I'm sort of mixing two things in the sense that there's this deep sort of, you know, interest in mystical experience and mystical literature and spiritual but not religious movements. And we both shared in that over the last decades. But then you kind of began to pursue, as you say, authors of the impossible and mystics and mutants. You began to pursue more the sort of paranormal side, which was sort of, you know, a little bit the sort of stepchild of that movement and hadn't come out into the open in quite the same way. It was there. It's certainly there and a lot of curiosity about it. But, you know, paranormal experience, all experience around UFOs and abductions, it hadn't really been brought into the light. It was kind of on the edges of that movement. And you got really interested in it. I love I think Mystics and Mutants is one of the most unique books. I'd love for you just to give a little overview and tell listeners like what that book is, how that inspired you, what that book expresses. Because I tell you, that book really opened my eyes.
Yeah. So yeah, that book has a real backstory to it too. I wrote this big history of the Esalen Institute called Esalen America and the Religion of No Religion. And it's really not a history of Esalen. It's really a history of the whole California counterculture.
Yes.
All of the esoteric currents that flowed through there, psychedelic and Asian and parapsychological and science fictional. It's just the whole thing. And as I was finishing that book in about 2006, I became obsessed with, of all things, the X-Men. And I wasn't even a fan of the X-Men as a kid. I was a Spider-Man guy.
I was a Spider-Man guy, totally. Yeah,
my brother was an Incredible Hulk guy, and I was a Spider-Man guy. And the X-Men were like this B team of the Marvel universe.
Yeah.
Which, as you remember, it wasn't anything like people think today. It was this inappropriate. It was soft porn for 12-year-olds. Yeah, right, exactly. It was sold literally in drugstores. You know, you had to go in and buy the pornography, and you'd buy the Marvel superhero comics on the wire rack. And but I just became obsessed with the X-Men. I'm like, what is going on? And then I had this really kind of mind-boggling synchronicity around one or two of the X-Men movies about the same time. And I started to puzzle about this. And then I realized something at the very end of the Esalen book, that the human potential movement, as you know, the basic idea is that evolution grants human beings specific anomalous abilities or powers. And the human potential movement was created to nurture and cultivate those abilities and to integrate them into culture. And I realized, I'm like, oh my God, that's the X-Men mythology.
That's Professor Xavier.
Yeah, there's like no difference. And of course, the difference was is that the X-Men mythology was invented in New York for kids, basically, in 1963. And the human potential movement was invented in late 1962, really, and it was meant as a serious kind of spiritual movement. So you had this kind of bi-coastal thing that was erupting at the same time, a kind of mythology for kids on the East Coast and a real world spiritual movement on the West Coast. And I was like, wow, that is so interesting. What's going on there? And so I decided to look into the spiritual lives of authors and artists who essentially created these superheroes and created science fiction. And the basic thesis, which I eventually arrived at, was that some of the greatest artists and authors were precisely the same people who had had the most profound paranormal experiences. And that instead of trying to prove these, they turned them into art. And I found that A, gorgeous, and B, much more creative and productive than trying to shove them into some kind of positivist, you know, laboratory proof or disprove.
Yes.
And so I wrote this book called Mutants and Mystics, and it's really all about the paranormal lives of these artists and authors. And what happened was a couple things happened. That was my fourth book with Chicago by that time. So they knew me well, and they wanted to do something special. And so they gave it to this designer, this book designer, who turns out was a comic book geek from, you know, way back, and was just basically waiting his whole life for this book. And Michael just went ballistic, basically. And we raised some money, and we raised enough money to do the whole thing in full color. And so the entire book is, as I'm sure you know, is printed in full color. And it's just this gorgeous art object that tries to capture the paranormal weirdness of these people's lives and how central these ideas really are to the science fiction and the comic books. And it really, you know, it's really had an impact on later filmmakers and authors and artists, which is wonderful. I mean, that's sort of what I had hoped for.
Yeah.
So that's the story behind that book.
And reading that book, I remember it also, in an odd way, it made you realize that, you know, so many of those paranormal and esoteric and mystical sort of notions had, as you said, sort of come out of the lives of those creators and sort of flowed into the comic books, right, and had sort of been seeded in there. And I even remember, as you know, 12, 13 year, I remember reading things about, you know, I read Spider-Man was my favorite, but I read widely in the Marvel universe. Yeah. And I remember experiencing some sense that there was a little mystical edges and tones and little things all throughout. You know, I even at 12, and I was, you know, my older brothers were interested in Eastern philosophy, so I had some sense of that. But I was aware that that was there, but I had no idea how deep the rabbit hole really went until I read that book. That was a real revelation, and it also makes you realize that so many of these kinds of stories of paranormal phenomenon, of esoteric phenomenon, of mystical phenomenon sort of exist behind the culture a bit, you know, just on the edges. You just have to look a little further, but if you don't, you won't see it, but it's just there. And you've, you know, I knew some of that, but you've helped me realize that in a whole nother way. And that other piece of all of our childhoods, because I think most American kids were reading comic books in those days.
Oh yeah. No, they were, we all were. And, yeah, they were warping us all. And, yeah, but you know, the other idea in the book is that, and it's more of a critical observation, is that so the reason those artists and authors could get away with that, and that we, if you look at Netflix now, or you look at Amazon Prime, or you look at any of these streaming services today, about one out of every two of those series is something paranormal, right?
Yeah,
it's so true. It's everywhere. And part of me is grateful for that. The other part of me is kind of pissed off, though, because it's as if we're okay talking about these things as fiction, but we're actually not okay talking about them as real. And so you can make literally millions or billions of dollars creating fantasies for the screen, but if you actually take this stuff seriously and you try to work with it intellectually, you'll never get a job.
Yeah, right.
And so that angers me, Carter. And I'm like, what is wrong with this culture that it's so schizophrenic, you know? And so that's kind of what I'm trying to address is that. And I've talked to filmmakers, you know, and I've talked to special effects people. And I'm like, gosh, can't you do a film that doesn't present itself as fiction, but that presents this stuff as real? And their basic answer is no. And I'm like, why? Why can't you? And their answer is basically, we don't know if that'll make money. We don't. That could flop, and we could lose tens of millions or hundreds of millions of dollars. And I'm just like, oh my God, that's just not right.
Is it changing at all? What's your perception? I mean, you move widely in circles around this stuff. What's your perception of the academic world, and then beyond that too? Because you obviously move beyond in all kinds of cultural spaces. Is there any shift? Is there some?
Yeah. I get asked that a lot.
I'm sure.
I don't think there's not going to be the new age utopia on the horizon. But I think there are shifts. When I talk about these things in academic context, I get a lot of excitement, particularly from younger intellectuals. Mm-hmm. So I think there's a generational thing going on.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think with the cinematic or the filmmakers or the novelists, I hear a lot from novelists too, fiction writers. They have a lot more freedom than the historians and the philosophers and the scientists do. And the people I feel, in some sense, the most compassion for are the scientists, because they have to be the most in hiding, as it were. Mm-hmm. And a lot of them are just fascinated by all this and think it's real. Mm-hmm. But they also understand that there's really not any way to turn it into a science. And so they have to be careful. And so there's a kind of sociology of knowledge or a politics of knowledge here that it is really complicated.
Yeah. I always say about this is about mysticism now, or spiritual mysticism, not so much about paranormal or esoteric phenomenon. But I've often said, and this is sort of the basis of maybe a future book, but that it's a very odd situation, because you've got the traditionally religious that at least in the West aren't, the mystical insights that flow through those religions have sort of been subsumed in a certain relationship to the text and to the biblical literalism and the theology of it. And, it's not very, the mystical roots of those, of many of the Western Abrahamic traditions aren't super alive. They've kind of come outside the church in some way.
Yeah.
But I often say it's an odd situation. It's like, I don't know the numbers, but it's like 90% of the culture in the West, right, is like, doesn't have any relationship, or maybe it's 80 or 70% to these mystical roots and traditions. And then sometimes I feel like there's the 5% or something, or 10% that is absolutely completely fascinated by it. But sometimes doesn't study it. Also doesn't really study it critically and curious in it, is just wants to engage with it. And there's very few people who are engaged with it, but also interested in what it means and looking at it critically through all kinds of intellectual lens and looking at it in a sort of rigorous and sympathetic way, both. That's the space I find it's hard to find people in that space, and that's the space I always feel I'm most interested in.
Yeah. And of course, that's why I'm interested in this stuff. It's not about just one impossible story after another, and I believe it all. It's more that these things happen they're not supposed to happen. They totally violate how we think the world works or what a human being is. And they clearly want to be heard.
Yeah. So
why aren't we listening to them?
Why aren't we studying these?
Yeah, we should be listening. We should be telling different stories about
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
And so I couldn't agree. I couldn't agree. Yet. Now, Carter, what, you know, something we do know a lot about is the sociology of the paranormal. There are three sociologists who wrote this book called Paranormal America, and they go through all the statistics. And what's so revealing about it is that the skeptical debunking attitude is actually kind of itself an illusion. It's a very small percentage of the American population.
That makes sense, actually.
It's actually tiny. They're almost minuscule. And something like 76 or 80% of Americans have actually had a paranormal experience. Yeah,
there you go. Right, I mean,
exactly. It's like really
it's overwhelming.
Yeah. And the other thing we know about these topics is that actually education increases one's sympathy for them.
Interesting.
It does not remove it. And we know that certain religious orientations do suppress interest in them. And other religious orientations encourage or are neutral.
Yes.
The religious orientation that is most hostile to this stuff is actually evangelical Christians.
Interesting.
Yeah. But even they think it's all real, but they demonize it, you know?
Right. Literally.
It becomes demons. Right. So that's hardly a deaffirmation of the paranormal.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly. You know, it's a backwards affirmation.
Yeah. So, you know, it turns out that most of the culture is it's not even a question for them. And it's only this tiny slice of, you know, basically ideological materialists who have a bee in their bonnet, who are doing the debunking, but they're getting such a big chunk of the cultural bandwidth that it looks like that's the central position, but it's not actually.
Interesting. That makes sense.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, as long as we're on the paranormal, I want to get into a few different topics as we go through this, but you know, you invited me to CTR, which is the think tank at Esalen that hosts gatherings on different sort of topics and hosts kind of leaders and, or, you know, intellectuals and leaders in certain fields. And you invited me a few years ago, last time we saw each other, to one that was on paranormal phenomenon and on UFO phenomenon.
Yeah.
And it was fascinating to me. I felt like I really learned a few things there. But I had been interested in the world of UFOs in my 20s and my 30s a little bit. And I had just, you know, I'd read widely and I knew there was interesting things happening. And I read widely in the abduction phenomenon but, you know, there was also a lot of just stuff that was hard to fathom and hard to track, you know, it's a rabbit hole and it's all kinds of stuff in it. And at a certain point I sort of lost track of it. But every so often I'd step back in and check in to see what was happening. And it seemed like, I knew there was a lot of reality to it. I knew there were interesting things going on. And I understood that some people relate to the UFO phenomenon in this materialistic way, you know, ships from outer space, ships from out there. But I read enough and I knew enough and that you started to see, no, this is a crossover into the paranormal. These are the types of phenomenon that happen around what we kind of broadly call UFO phenomenon are interdimensional. They're associated with spiritual subtle realms. There are all kinds of paranormal esoteric worlds that cross and overlap with the UFO phenomenon. And I think, as we had hosted that gathering at Esalen, as you hosted that gathering, and I think I realized how much those worlds interpenetrate. And that it's kind of amazing that there hasn't been more interest in the academic world or just in studying how those worlds interpenetrate and all this fascinating crossover. And then you start to see, oh, the UFO phenomenon is not some, you know, It's not about, you know, flying saucers from 1950s. It's an esoteric phenomenon that's been interpenetrating culture really throughout history. And understanding it is really, it's understanding a lot more about what esoteric phenomenon is, what paranormal phenomenon is, who we are as humans. This is a phenomenon that's really been with us all of human history. And the idea that we're not studying it more rigorously, with more curiosity and interest, it starts to seem crazy that we aren't. And yet we haven't. And so I think that is beginning. It seems like it's really beginning. There's a lot more interest now. And of course, with the New York Times writing articles about UFOs, there's even more interest. Yeah. But you start to see more. So I'm curious, what's your sense of where all things stand in that field and how things are moving?
Well, I think that topic in particular is a good example of what we were saying earlier, that things really have shifted.
Yeah.
You know, the pieces in the New York Times by Ralph Blumenthal and Leslie Keene and a co-writer whose name I apologize escapes me, have really, I won't say single-handedly because there were three authors, but I mean, those essays, the first ones were in December of 2017, by the way. And basically what those essays have shown is that it's just not true what we've been told.
Yeah.
The government isn't interested in these things. The military is very interested.
Very interested, yeah.
And pilots encounter these things all the time. And the pilots themselves were pissed that they couldn't report these
things. Yeah, and they have been for years, right?
Yeah, they knew damn well that they were real. And so that reporting, and particularly because it was the New York Times, I think, has really shifted the conversation. And it's... the conversation is no longer do they exist or not. It's what the heck are they? And so that's really shifted. That's really, I think, helped in some way. Mm. To me, now, you know, I lecture and write a lot about the UFO phenomena. And to me, the most interesting part of it is, you know, we are trained, certainly in our universities, but also I think in our daily lives, to split the world up into these two realms called the mental and the material. And there are material objects out there, presumably in space and time, and they can be manipulated and measured. And that's how we do science and make smartphones and, you know, laptop computers. And here we are.
Yes.
But there's also this whole mental dimension of consciousness or awareness that doesn't seem to fit into any of that. Mm-hmm. And what's so strange and wonderful about the UFO phenomena is that it almost always involves both of those dimensions.
Yes.
And it challenges the division between them.
Yeah.
And that's, I think, the real provocation here. Mm. You know, on the lecture circuit, I used to joke that there are really just two things you have to understand the UFO phenomena. One is how radar works, and the other is revelation. And, you know, it's a joke, but it gets at this same point that, yes, these appear to be physical objects that can be picked up by radar technologies or the human eyeball, but they also have these esoteric or spiritual dimensions.
Yeah.
They don't have to have both, but they often do have both.
They often do, yeah.
Yeah, and you know, kind of in my gut, what I felt a lot is that, you know, what's so interesting about the military involvement is they don't know what the hell they're doing. And it's like they're using all this technology to basically study a planetary seance. And it just scares the shit out of them because they don't know what to do with a ghost or a spirit.
Yeah.
Except turn it into an enemy.
Yeah.
Right? And that's what's so dangerous here is when you start encountering entities and you turn them into demons or alien invaders, which is exactly what we've done.
Yeah.
With the UFO myth. And so that's where I think a cultural historian or a scholar of religion or an anthropologist can come in and say, now, wait a minute, why are you doing that?
Yeah.
You know, is that really productive? Because, you know, you could interact with ghosts and spirits in ways that aren't about invasion and terror and possession.
Yeah.
So that to me, that's what it's kind of about on some level, is challenging this whole cultural mythos and trying to cut through all the disinformation, much of which is intended, by the way, and trying to cut through all that. And, you know, I don't know quite how to do that, but I think that's the task. And the thing I always talk about here, Carter, which might help the listener, is I personally think there are two truly great UFO movies. The first one was Close Encounters of the Third Kind, which if you watched it, you know, was entirely formed around a massive precognitive experience of dozens of people.
Yes.
And so it linked the parapsychological and the ufological.
Yes.
The second and maybe even the better UFO movie is Arrival.
Oh, I loved it.
Well, the reason Arrival is so great is because it takes the American alien invasion trope and it reverses it.
Mm.
You know, if you remember the movie, the American military is there.
Yeah.
But they don't do anything.
Yeah, right. It's true.
They stand back. And the hero of the story is not the great macho fighter pilot. It's not even the male physicist. It's the female humanist. Mm-hmm. It's the linguist who figures out that these alien creatures have come here not to conquer us, but to communicate with them.
Yeah.
And she learns how to crack their code, which turns out to be circular. And it looks a lot like a Zen emptiness symbol.
Yeah.
And it turns out it's all about time and temporality and circularity and precognition again.
Yeah.
And I was just so moved by that. And by the way, I think that's a Canadian director. So he's, you know, breaking with this American macho myth. And of course, it's based on a short story. And it just entirely breaks with the old UFO invasion myth. And adds, I think, something really profound to the storytelling and something very, frankly, very faithful to UFO contacts.
Yeah.
So.
I found that the movie so beautiful. Also, there was this, in the movie when she's having the precognitions, you don't know they're precognitions,
no,
right?
You don't know.
And that was beautifully done, I thought, because I thought during the movie, I thought, oh no, I'm loving this movie, but I don't like we have to focus on her psychological trauma. It was sort of I thought, well, this is just another movie. They want to have this big personal psychological trauma and her background and all this. And we keep having these flashbacks and it's like, okay, in part of my mind, I was like, I can do without this piece of it. There's so much else that's going on here that's interesting. And as it turns out, it wasn't that at all. It was a precognition, and then it beautifully wrapped itself around the whole sort of temporality of the movie. And it was wonderful. I loved that. That was so well done.
Yeah, and you know, Carter, you asked me earlier about what I was doing now, and we got off on other things. I didn't mean to push the question aside, but this is a wonderful segue into what I'm doing. You know, I've been reading Nietzsche for about a year now, and I had never really read Nietzsche. I had read around him or had seen endless references to him, but I had never really read him. And for those who have not read Nietzsche, he's one of those authors whom people read and they remember reading him for the rest of their life. I mean, he really changes people. Two central doctrines or teachings. One was the eternal recurrence of the same, this circular nature of time that Arrival was partly about. And the other was the coming Superman or the Ubermensch or the superhumans. And reading Nietzsche, it it has dawned on me that he is the real, in some ways, the source of evolutionary spiritualities of the 20th century and now the 21st century. I always thought it might have been Aurobindo, it might have been Teilhard de Chardin, maybe it was Alfred Russel Wallace. I actually think it was Nietzsche. And that raises a whole set of questions, you know, that we need to struggle with. But when you read Nietzsche, and you know his ideas, he didn't think these thoughts. These things were revealed to him.
Mm.
And he speaks in that language, by the way.
Mm.
He's usually thought of as the greatest atheist of all time, but I think he was the worst atheist of all time. He talks endlessly about his own divine states and his own divinity and becoming a god. And I think he was entirely serious. I think he really had these experiences.
Mm.
And you know, then he collapses, you know, from madness, and we never hear again from him. And so what most readers do is they say, oh, all that religious stuff, that's just Nietzsche going mad. But if you know something about comparative mystical literature, you recognize it instantly.
Mm.
He wasn't mad. He was waking up.
Mm.
And so that's kind of what I'm doing now. And the basic idea isn't to be a Nietzschean. The basic idea is to say that these classical authors that we read in the humanities really were writing out of altered states of consciousness, altered states of knowledge, and that the humanities are really the superhumanities.
Mm.
They're really about the superhuman nature that we are trying to access through these ideas or reading practices, but also some kind of superhumanity we may well be evolving towards, which is what Nietzsche thought, by the way.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
I mean, he almost certainly meant a real biological species that would take over from these stupid humans. That's the X-Men mythology, Carter. I mean, if you want Nietzsche, just go listen to Magneto in the latest, you know, X-Men movie. That's Nietzsche, you know?
That's so awesome. That's great.
Yeah. So it's so amazing to me how this story has been with us since the 1880s, and we're still struggling with it. And I think rightfully so. I think the X-Men mythology at its best is really a big debate between Xavier and Eric.
Yes.
About what evolution is and whether these abilities should be integrated into the human species or whether the mutants should overcome or take over from the humans. I mean, that's
right. Is there a break or is there a, that's interesting.
Yeah. And I'm very much a Professor Xavier kind of guy. I think these things will come from us and it's a pretty integrative future, but you know, there are people who would disagree and there are people who would reject all of this and say it's fascist.
Yeah.
You know,
That's
essentially the Magneto character.
Yeah.
So to me, that's all, those are really serious questions and really important conversations to have. And so that's what I've been doing recently is really thinking about, you know, I'm an associate dean, which just basically means I'm a little guy in a dean's office, but I'm sitting at the side of the stage watching everybody do their thing. And I have this view of the show, as it were, and I'm developing a real kind of appreciation for the humanities as a whole, as opposed to one particular discipline.
Mm. Mm.
And I'm also worried that the humanities have lost their sense of the superhumanities. We've become flatlanders, essentially.
Yeah. Say more about that. That makes sense to me. I you know, we need the humanities to play a role in society. It feels like we need them to be enriched, and it feels like they're being diminished.
They are. You know, and I don't mean that in any. I'm not a conspiracy theorist. I'm not a doomsday, you know, prophet. But I mean, it's just obvious that when young people come to universities and colleges today, they're shepherded away from critical, reflexive thinking in the humanities, and they're shepherded towards what we call the STEM fields, which, you know, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, they're all important and wonderful things,
yeah.
often really lack what I would call a reflexive edge to them. In other words, they're not aware of their own assumptions.
Yeah.
They don't think about thinking.
Yeah, exactly.
They just do what they do really well. And it also often can have very negative influences on human beings. And so I think this humanist notion of thinking about thinking and not thinking one's thoughts and not believing one's beliefs and stepping out of one's own inherited culture is actually the key to our survival. Mm-hmm. And so I'm just a huge fan of that approach. And that's precisely what's being diminished or defunded, or in some sectors of our society, Carter, just mocked.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. And I think it's mocked by people who understand on some level they have no real answer to it.
Yeah.
So it's easier to mock something than to answer it.
Yeah. You know, you talk in the Flip, the book, one of your recent books, is it maybe your last book? You know, you talk about cosmic humanism, and I call myself sometimes an evolutionary humanist, you know, which is sort of, you know, it kind of, and because I'm a generalist and I love, you know, not that I've spent a lot of time in the academic world. I haven't, but I appreciate, like you said, that the ability to think about thinking, that critical ability, and also the curiosity, that sense of I understand enough about the world around me, and I'm an expert in enough disciplines to have the right kind of curiosity and critical mind when I look at other things, when I look at anything, you know, not just as a skeptic, but as a sort of engaged critical thinker. Sometimes I feel like you have to be an expert in one or two things, and then you can look at other things. But if you just go down one hole, you know, you just become a biologist. You know, when I wrote Evolutionaries, I was kind of amazed. I went to a couple, you know, conferences on biology, you know, on sort of, you know, biology and a couple of conferences on evolution and talking about Darwin and you know, just they were really interesting in many ways. But it took me back a couple times when I dipped my interest into the academic world. I was interviewing people in that world. They would get very siloed. It would surprise me, you know, because a lot of people are critical of that, but it seemed to be really true. And I don't know if that's true across the academic world, but that siloed nature, it definitely, and then you start having sort of, you know, micro intellectual battles with the person who thinks something slightly different, and you can't, and you aren't able to kind of look at this broader picture. And I could go on, but that's, I so appreciate that you're bringing that perspective and at least pushing that point of view.
Yeah. And of course we actually talk about silos all the time, Carter, and it's not in a good sense. I mean, you know, but the truth is that people generally are trained in disciplines and they're rewarded for succeeding in those disciplines. Sure. And so they tend to become more and more technical and speak in more and more theoretical terms. And as a result, their audience becomes smaller and smaller. Yeah. And the way I put that, you know, about halfway through my career, I said, you know, I think I'm tired of writing for 50 people in the world, yeah, right. 25 of whom hate me. And I think I'm done with that. I'm gonna try to reach more people. And so I did. I hope so. I don't know.
I want to say you write, people should read you because you write beautifully. You write very well. You don't write. I mean, I'm not trying to be critical of academics, but you don't write like an academic. You write like someone who's writing for a popular audience, and you write extremely well for that audience. So
I really try so hard, Carter, and I try to be funny and I try to wear my heart on my sleeve.
Yeah,
but what, what astonishes me, you know, this is the fate of an academic, I think. With every book you publish, you think that there are going to be fireworks in the sky and the world, is going to change the next day. And you know what? It doesn't. And nobody even notices. And you're like, well, who's listening? You know? And so that can be very hard.
Toiling through books are not easy, and books are wonderful things on one hand because they exist. They're like these artifacts that just exist out there in culture, and they influence and they can live for hundreds of years. But they take their books are an extraordinary amount of work. And I think when you put that much work into birthing something creative, boy, it's hard to hear that silence on the other end.
Yep.
Well, that's back to Nietzsche for a sec. You know, this is something close to my heart, obviously. You know, my book, Evolutionaries, was so much about this idea that we're part of this larger flow, this larger sort of evolutionary flow, and that there's a human potential in the future, and culture is moving and we are moving, and this, you know, breaking with this idea of a sort of static universe and a static biological universe, a static cultural universe, a static mental universe, a static, you know, breaking fundamentally with this idea that we're in this kind of creative evolutionary ongoing journey, and to get people to consider that, to think about what that means, and then share some of the people throughout the last couple hundred years that have really been so prominent in bringing our attention to that. And I wasn't a Nietzschean. I don't know Nietzsche as well, but you know, so many other people, like you say, Aurobindo and Teilhard and some of the German idealists who Michael Murphy is so fond of, and people more recently, and Jean Gebser, and these people who are saying, hey, we're part of this larger journey. And we're part of this kind of unfolding, there's something inspirational in that. When you start to think in those, what I call, you know, evolutionary terms, there's a kind of meaning that leaps out of that perspective, that and a possibility and a kind of an awakening of a joy for the future, and a sense of that this human journey has this rich and, you know, past, and we can look at that past, but that past is sort of prelude to all this possibility. And of course, we could mess it up in all kinds of ways, and we certainly have been good at that in certainly all kinds of ways. But there's this kind of inherent sort of optimism and meaning-filled perspective in that. So what's your sense of that? I always feel like that's so needed today, something that lights us up beyond just going to work, you know?
Well, of course, I agree with you, Carter. And my commitment to the human potential movement is a commitment to a kind of evolutionary spirituality.
Yeah.
That's the whole commitment. And, you know, the way I often talk about it is, you know, it's not called the human accomplishment movement. It's called the human potential movement. And the idea is that the fuller truth resides in the future.
Yeah.
Not the past.
Yeah.
And the religions all basically work on a backward looking assumption that the full truth was revealed at such and such a time by such and such a person. And life is about essentially trying to get back to that truth or imitating or believing that truth. So it's a backward looking orientation. What I find so remarkable about the human potential movement and really any of these evolutionary esotericisms is they turn around essentially, mm-hmm. and they say, no, that was all well and good. We learned a lot, but that's not the full truth, and that life doesn't stop. And if you want to be theistic about it, God doesn't speak in periods. He speaks in commas, and you know, he or she or it is still speaking. And so revelation in this model is, to be theological about it, is it's a continual revelation. It's not a once and for all or a definitive scriptural event. It's ongoing. Yeah. And the other really powerful thing about all this is it again links the material and the mental. You know, evolution is about biology, for God's sake.
Yeah.
It's about sex, by the way.
Yeah.
You don't get evolution without lots and lots of sex. And yet in this view, it's also something deeply spiritual. It's about God waking up as the physical universe. And so it's this fusion of the deeply, deeply physical and material and the deeply, deeply spiritual or mystical. And that's just really profound. And I think that's what people find so powerful about it.
Yeah.
So that's, I mean, that's what I think about it. And, you know, part of it too is what do you want to believe in? And I mean, we can believe in an evolution that's entirely mechanical and random and frankly depressing, and we will be depressed. Or we can believe in an evolution that is somehow conscious and intelligent, but also violent and also extinctual in many moments, and we will be engaged and excited. And so for me, it's like, no, I'd rather live in that that latter world. Mm-hmm. And I also happen to know a number of evolutionary biologists, and I can tell you the whole Darwinian thing is up for grabs now. It is not a settled.
It's opened up some.
It's really opened up. And, you know, evolution has gotten weirder and weirder.
It has. It's continued to, even at a scientific level. I mean,
oh my God. Moment,
the other dimensions of it, it's gotten very interesting. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's really true, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah. And it was in the original days, you know, there was more, we went through this period where, you know, I think evolution felt like the evolutionary biology felt like it had to consolidate its gains and sort of went on this sort of trench warfare against religion. And in doing that, it had to kind of block out everything else. And, now it feels like it's opening up again, the interest in what this is.
My earlier comment, a lot of these scientists are just in the closet. They don't think it's random and meaningless, but you know, they can't always say that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I, you know, you mentioned that, you know, so much of traditional religion often will look to the past. I was fascinated when I did a study on the messianic movements in traditional religion, of which I didn't realize until I did that study, but you know, almost every traditional religion has a form of messianic kind of a story and embedded in it.
Yeah.
And I was, you know more about this than I do, but I always felt like it was a sort of there was a proto evolutionary point of view in a lot of those religious movements, even though it was obviously that's, you know, the future returns you to the past and the Messiah will come and that will deliver on the promise of the past. And there's this kind of circular thing in it, but there's also inherently, there's this kind of looking forward for what's coming, for the possibilities of the future. And now in our own age, you can see how that sort of turned into the possible, into human potential, into the possibilities of where we can evolve to, into the changes that our culture can undergo. And that a kind of hope that we can find our way. And it may not be messianic, but the hope is that core of hope is in the evolutionary message.
Yeah, and this is what, you know, we, in the study of religion, we call eschatology.
Yeah.
Essentially, it's the doctrine of the end things of a particular religious system. And, you know, to go back to the UFO phenomena, one of the things I'd said in my lectures when we used to be able to travel, I'd said, you know, the UFO isn't about technology, it's about eschatology. And what I meant by that is, you know, it's about the soul and death and the afterlife and all of these things that we associate with, you know, the end. And so it, you know, it takes you back to that. And I think you're right. I think a lot of these religions had this implicit evolutionary sense to them, but they of course didn't have the intellectual framework that Darwin and his successors have given us.
Yeah. Yeah. That's really, That is a fascinating aspect of the UFO phenomenon. People don't realize that it has this eschatological element. It's often and it often manifests around eschatological contexts of death. And things like that. That is very interesting in and of itself.
I mean, something Ann Streber used to say all the time. I mean, Whitley's partner, and who went through hundreds of thousands of letters that Whitley received over the years, and she commented many times that one of the standing motifs of these letters was that dead loved ones often appeared in the abduction itself. So you'd have the alien gray doing whatever it's doing, but you'd also see your dead grandfather or a friend whom you didn't even know was dead, and then you'd find out later that this friend had died. So what are the dead doing with the aliens? It's kind of a problem if they're, you know, from the star system Sirius or something.
That's fascinating.
Yeah.
I wanted to you know, another area in which you've studied and you've thought more deeply about than a lot of people, I think, is you know, the nature of mysticism itself. And we were just talking about these evolutionary potentials, and I think in my sort of, you know, early experience of mysticism and pursuits of the spiritual path, you know, you and somewhat maybe intellectually naive at the time, but you sort of, you know, there was this kind of simple point of view where these deep, either paranormal or esoteric phenomena that people experience, I sort of looked up to as sort of, wow, that's so cool, and I want to experience that. And these deep mystical phenomenon, I want to have those experiences. And those represent the sort of the, you know, higher heights of human development and higher heights of human potential. And as I've, you know, decades later, as I've had a lot of those experiences, and I've known so many people who've had, and I've shared and drank from those cups in all kinds of ways, I see it more complex ways. You know, sometimes, and you've talked about this, sometimes, you know, it's so easy to have a profound esoteric or paranormal or mystical experience and then immediately want to put that state of being on top of whatever our evolutionary lather is, you know? Right. And, but I see it much more complex ways. Some experiences I think are maybe hearkening back to earlier periods in our evolution. Maybe when we were more psychically intertwined, some might be, intuitions of our own potential. Some psychic, experiences clearly happen to people who've had traumatic experiences or psychological breaks, and it's not necessarily a sign of psychological health, and yet it allows them access to some other dimension. It's a much more fluid and complex picture than in my I had those days. And you're someone who's really explored that.
Yeah, you know, one of my more unpopular ideas that has not got much traction, but I really think is essentially true, is that mystical states have very little to do with moral behavior.
Absolutely. Absolutely true. I agree. It hasn't got much traction. That's interesting.
Yeah. I mean, people don't want to hear that. They want to be told that their saint or their teacher is somehow morally perfect. And I've never thought that. I think that, you know, I think the human is two, essentially. And by that, I don't mean in any dualistic sense, but I think there's this human ego or person that, you know, you and Carter and Jeff are now talking, and that's the level on which we can talk about morality and ethical behavior. Yeah. But these sort of non-dual monistic levels that are the level of mystical experience, those are also beautiful and cosmic and powerful, but they're not moral.
Yes.
You know, and it's just a mistake. So it's a terrible mistake. to conflate those two. And it's a terrible mistake for two reasons. One is, if you conflate those two, then when your spiritual teacher does something bad, you actually have to reject the spiritual teacher.
Yeah.
You know, but if you keep them apart, you can say, okay, he's a jerk, but he's also enlightened.
Yeah.
You know, and those are two entirely different things.
Yeah.
So separating them actually allows us to have a lot more capacity and a lot more compassion. And it also allows us to be smarter because, you know, saints are dangerous people.
Yeah.
And they themselves aren't in control of the fireworks, you know? And once we recognize that, then we can accept the fireworks for the fireworks and not naively think that that makes them or us better people.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't. I'm sorry. It just doesn't.
It doesn't. And we've had enough evidence of that at this point.
Well, you would think, but
I mean, and people sort of, they either like, it sort of goes back to that. Either they want to put it on a pedestal and say, it must be all pure and wonderful, or we want to reject it altogether and there's nothing of value there.
Right. And my view is, please don't do that.
Yeah.
Please honor the Enlightenment as powerful and important.
Yeah.
Please also struggle with the moral and ethical issues.
Yeah.
But don't conflate them. Don't conflate them.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so that's.
And for those experiencers themselves, I think it would help them, because I think sometimes they are then put into a position where they start to feel, and I've known, they start to feel like, well, I must have some moral and ethical advantage or there must, you know, because I've had this profound experience. It's like they're culturally almost, there's a way in which those experiences can convince you of your own deification in a way that is not true. And I feel like if there was a more robust cultural conversation that said, no, we shouldn't assume that, then even the experiencers who may have deep mystical experience would not then conclude that they have all of this sort of purity on a human realm, which is sort of absurd if you think about it. But a lot of people believe that.
Well, I think a lot of these people actually experience themselves as God, and I think they're correct, but that doesn't mean their egos are God, for God's sake. It means some deeper aspect. So I think that's the distinction we need to make as a culture. And of course, we don't do that, Carter. We're spiritually stupid.
Yeah.
We don't even acknowledge those states as possible.
Exactly. Most people aren't even in that conversation.
No, we're not even close to that.
Yeah. You can see a robust, sophisticated conversation. In some ways, I feel like that's the conversation you've been trying to initiate there at Rice and at S. Lennon, and in our own way at the magazine. I was part of What Is Enlightenment. We were trying to initiate that conversation too. Let's have a robust conversation. Let's have a critical conversation, not a skeptical, anti conversation, but a robust, interested, curious, critical conversation. Let's not assume. Something.
Yeah. No, you were having that conversation and you were doing a wonderful, I remember I was kind of coming into my professional life and when that magazine was really at its height and, you know, you were all showing up at the AAR, the American Academy of Religion. And you were doing that. You were doing that. And I think, you know, something like, is it Shambhala? What's the Shambhala publication?
Yeah, Shambhala. Shambhala.
Tricycle does that. I think there are there are places where that conversation, and it's not just that spiritual teachers can be imperfect human beings. It's also to push it even further. Sometimes the most profound spiritual experiences occur in trauma.
This is another underappreciated truth. Psychic and mystical experiences are sometimes the result of a traumatic break.
Absolutely. And spiritual experiences and psychopathology are not exclusive either. I mean, people have enlightenment experiences in psychotic breaks. They're not exclusive of one another. And we're just so unsophisticated about that, you know.
Early on, I realized that I realized a lot of people who had had psychic experiences had been abused as kids.
Yeah,
you know, that was part of it. You know,
sexuality, trauma,
and so you just these are issues that unfortunately it's hard to, there's not forums to really explore these things, but that became very clearly true. And I realized at a certain point also that certain types of what we call enlightenment, as you were saying, you know, like certain types of the way, I mean, this is another conversation probably, but the way in which people have mystical experiences in a way in which they seem to become sort of ratcheted into their psyche. That happens to a certain type of personality. It doesn't happen to another type of personality. These are interesting questions, you know?
You know, William James talked about the firstborn and the secondborn, or the sick soul and the healthy soul. And that's kind of what he was trying to get at.
Yeah.
That's just true, you know?
Yeah. No, I feel like there's very few people you can have these kind of conversations with. You know, it's like you get to the point of mysticism, legit or not. It's hard to get beyond that and then start having the more interesting conversations about what it is, how does it manifest, what does it mean about human development, human evolution, what does it mean about our psychology, what does it mean about all these things, and have really interesting critical dialogues as opposed to, that person's now this special saint or we're going to ignore it altogether. You know?
Oh yeah. We're going to just ban that person.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
Yeah, I mean, it's really not smart, and it's really unfortunate, and it causes so much human suffering for both the followers and the teachers. And I just feel a lot of compassion on both sides for that, and so unnecessary.
Yeah, you feel like we could do better. Why can't we?
We can do better.
Yeah. Of course we can. Yeah. And I think you've been someone who has been a sort of a place that people have sought you out, who also have had some very profound paranormal experiences, sometimes as a result of trauma, or sometimes people get struck by lightning and they, you know, sometimes people can have near death experiences, and it seems to. Well, so
Carter, tell me what near death experience could there be that isn't traumatic?
Exactly.
I mean, by definition, you just about died. So, I mean,
you know. I think it qualifies.
Yeah, I think that qualifies. But also on the other experiences, I mean, when people come to me, and they come to me all the time now, it's more than I can't even answer my email anymore.
Oh, I bet. I feel for you. You know,
when I do sit down with someone, somewhere in the back of my head, I'm like, okay, here comes the sex. And then it's, okay, here comes the trauma.
Right.
And okay, here comes the sexual trauma. And it's just like clockwork. I mean, it's just so predictable. And Elizabeth Crone, whom you reference, is just a perfect example of that. She's this Houston woman, a wonderful human being, good friend of mine, struck by lightning in 1988 in the parking lot of her synagogue, and had this incredible near-death experience, and then became massively precognitive. But when we started working on the book together, I was just waiting, and second time we sat down, she just unloads this, you know, horrific 6-year story of childhood rape, essentially. And I was like, Elizabeth, how do you hold that? And she's like, well, I think it has something to do with my near-death experience. I'm like, yeah, so do I. And she didn't mean to reduce her near-death experience to the sexual trauma. Essentially, what she was trying to articulate, and I think I helped her, is that somehow the sexual trauma, as awful as it was, gave her dissociative skills that later resulted in the near-death experience.
Yeah.
And she could use the same skill set in a different context for very positive ends.
Yeah.
She wasn't equating them, but she was definitely connecting them. And I think she was right. I think she was right to connect them.
It makes sense if you think of, you know, I always thought if you think of that kind of abuse as a young person, you learn to disassociate. You learn to sort of go out of your body. That's almost a sort of natural reaction to that kind of abuse, is to disassociate from your body. And that's inevitably, where do you go then? You associate with something that's not physical, and you associate with some non-physical realms in some way. It seems almost a natural that would, at least leave one open to something else to connect to some other less physical place.
Yeah. And Carter, life will traumatize you.
Yeah, that's true too.
Life will fucking kill you. Every single time.
Yeah.
So as a species, we, I think, have evolved to be trauma. I mean, of course we're going to be traumatized. If we're not traumatized by one another, illness, accident, death, loss of loved ones, something is going to traumatize us every single time, probably multiple times. And so we have evolved to respond to that, I think, spiritually. And so I think living in the modern world, we naively think we can somehow live lives without trauma. I just think that's naive. That's just not going to happen.
Yeah. And it's clear that our past wasn't less traumatic than our current. It was more.
I often joke, you know, the historian was asked, you know, what period of history would you like to live in? And his response was any time after penicillin.
Yeah, right. There you go.
You know, or just fill in the blank, anytime after anesthesia, frankly.
Yeah.
I mean, come on. You want trauma and suffering. Oh,
God. I mean, we even get a little piece of it right now, but can you imagine? I mean, what pandemics? You know,
pulling out rotten teeth without any Novocaine.
Exactly. Sometimes I look at my teeth. Yes. I have a lot of issues with my teeth, but I'm thankful I live now, not even four decades ago. I mean, you know. Who knows what my teeth would look like? Who knows what I would look like?
Yeah. You wouldn't have any teeth.
Thank God for evolution. I mean, evolution and you know, this is why we need all of it. We need technology, we need science, we need spirit, we need mysticism, we need all the pieces of it, you know, to move forward. We need it all. And I wish we could sort of have a sort of wider embrace of it all, and not carve up the world in the way that it's so easy to do.
Yeah.
Well, Jeff, this has been wonderful. I know I won't keep you. I enjoyed talking. I enjoyed the cover. So tell me briefly before we go, the new book, when it might be out, when we might be able to expect.
Yeah, there is no new book yet. Okay. But I mean, I'm writing it. It's called The Superhumanities, and I'm hoping it'll be out in a couple years. Let's say that.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you. Thanks, Jeff. And take care. And let's do it again before long.
Okay, Carter. Thank you.
I want to thank Jeff Kripal for coming on the podcast today. I really enjoyed our conversation, and I look forward to many more in the future. And a reminder for those of you who are interested in following this podcast, you can find out all the latest news and information about it by signing up for my newsletter, which is also called Thinking Ahead. And you can sign up for that at carterphipps.com/newsletter. All right, that's it for this edition of Thinking Ahead. I look forward to next time.